Oh, well, thanks very much for inviting me to give a talk here. It's surprising for me because I haven't worked too much on Harari Lipschitz, but I'll give a talk anyways. So HL would stand for Harari Lipschitz, right? So I had two papers on the subject, one with Yanwen Sheng, whom many of you know, and he works now for Citi. And also last year, I had a paper with Carlos, who is here. Basically, my talk will be a long stream of introduction or and some ideological stuff attached to it. Then I'll talk about preserving Lorentz invariance in the meta sector by making a scale separation, basically the Kozhawa-Lipschitz scale, much smaller than M. Planck. And then I will go to the sort of discuss various possible problems with that, and by discussing this recent paper, which basically marrying Lipschitz to Suzy. Yes, with Carlos. So we all know that we take two elementary particles and look at the graviton exchange, that this is likely to be a very small effect, because the in the vertex you will have some sort of a momentum divided by the Planck scale here and there, and unless you put many particles there, you will not going to have a strong effect. And even if you put many particles here, this particle will never make a sharp turn. So we all know that. But how about this? In principle, since Q in the loop can go very far, then we do have some sort of sensitivity to UV scales starting from a graviton loop exchange, and we all know how to basically treat that if the UV theory has the same degrees of symmetries, basically, as the lower dimensional, as low energy theory. So if it has, if there's an electron, right, and out of this loop will come something like this, where one comes from the sort of three level, from the main part in the Lagrangian, and then there would be M Planck squared, lambda squared, where this is the UV cutoff that I would have to introduce somehow, times maybe 1 over 16 pi squared. This is somewhat naive, but it's I think it's right. So this whole thing can be basically subsumed into the renormalization of the wave function and would not cause any particular problem. And that's very importantly. And, you know, people have pushed this framework further, calculating like corrections to Newton law and et cetera. In particular, last year we had a talk by John Donahue doing exactly that. And this is all nice, but that's assuming that UV theory has all this has all same symmetries. As I are. But there has been interest to theorists that do, for example, have a reduced degrees of symmetries in the UV. So in that sense, that one can expect some other interesting effects. So suppose for example, that I don't know that there's some quantum gravity gives you some preferred time plus lattice in 3D, right? That's lattice in space dimension. Plus time, right? That's a naive way of discretizing things. Maybe it works, right? If that's the case, then nobody tells you that these corrections should go this way, right? And then these radiative corrections can create a mismatch between, say, this term and this term, and then if this coefficient is slightly different from one, then you can have basically a correction to the speed of light coming from the UV theory, right? Well, if that's the case, speed of electron, right? And then of course you can there is all this wonderful experimental information that that the speed of electron minus the speed of E now I can be sort of somewhat vague, but there are more up to date constraints. It's something at the level of 10 to minus 22 or something like that. So you can get these constraints by looking at various astrophysics sources, or interestingly, you can get it even at low energy because essentially your electrons, you can study their behavior in atoms and look at the decoupling of spins to the preferred directions, and at some level, this all affects the low energy experiments. So. This sort of tells you, looking back here, that if indeed lambda UV is sort of naively comparable to M Planck, then this is a huge problem for theories with with broken Lorentz invariants in the UV. I think it's pretty uncontroversial. Now, Proposal that I would like to make, and I return to this in the context of Khajal elections, is that there can be a situation where the lambda UV, in some sense, much smaller than M Planck. In that sense, if that's the case, I'll specify what I mean here. If that is the case, then Lorentz violation, at least in the gravity sector, is allowed, not forbidden at 10 to minus 20 level. That's the statement. So now the interest to all this in the last 5 years, or I mean, I was looking at this related subjects for a long time, but my interest was picked by Harjava gravity. That makes an interesting modifications to the graviton propagators. And and they have a better UV behavior than usual stuff. So basically, if you have a normal massless propagator for a particle propagating with the speed one, Harjava modification is, or Lifshitz modification, I don't know. It's been discussed for a long time, but first in connection to gravity by Harjava, I think. So this, for example, make the following modification. Of the propagator. Then if you go back to the to this loop and calculate this loop that would normally be a kind of quadratically divergent. So let's write it as d3k and d omega, and take the integral over omega first, and then you'll end up with d3k k vector plus k vector cube over lambda squared. So basically, if before you could argue, well, this integral, it diverges like a square, and that's where this statement comes from. Now you can see that the idea is that let's take this higher derivative terms seriously, meaning like they're not effective terms that are in effective theory, and once you reach the scale, you know, the theory is no longer applicable. So Harjava's idea is to really make this into some sort of a serious idea that this is a nice regulator, if you like, because you can see that it only gives a log of lambda UV over lambda Harjava Lifshitz, right? If you integrate across this scale here. All right. So this that is very nice. It is reminiscent of you know, when people put k mu squared minus k mu squared over lambda. Now I put LW, Liouville, of some sort of thing. If you calculate a loop, this k mu squared, fourth power of momentum, right? So that would be also regularized in the UV. But the problem with that is that at some level it is equivalent to basically a negative norm state of some sort. So it is the Ghost and the tachyon at the same time. And some people do have not Harjava Lifshitz, Liouville. As some people do try to make this theory seriously as a UV theory, but I don't see any big, you know, victories on this path. So that's why I really liked this proposal of modifying gravity propagators. And of course, as you can see here, the graviton propagators break Lorentz invariance order one because they don't have any more omega equals to k dispersion, but they have omega equals to proportional to k cubed dispersion above the Harjava-Lifshitz scale.
So, I should say, in a sense, you say that this is like not nobody takes that seriously, but in a sense that's what everybody does, because everybody who doesn't live in Lorentz violation lives in Lorentz symmetry, so they have to use a regulator. It's either dimensional regularization that has no physical meaning, or it's basically Pauli-Villars, which is exactly
is very similar to Pauli-Villars. Yes, yeah. It's a negative norm. Yes, yes.
So there's no physical. There is no physical Lorentz invariant.
No, but right. What I meant is to say that there is a stream of recent 5 or 6 years papers where people try to make sense of a physical state as a Liouville states that has negative norms and so on. So I honestly don't know where that will go, right? I mean, but anyways, this is a nicer proposal. Yes, there is a huge sacrifice made here. Lorentz violation is gone. Sorry, Lorentz invariance is gone. But there is at least some sort of hope that theory doesn't have a six states. Yes, John.
QED one, and also spontaneous symmetry, which you do not violate the gauge invariance. Now, the gauge invariance is right quantum gravity, is the local Lorentz invariance. So you violate the gauge invariance.
Yes, this is not a GR now, right?
So therefore, you have to worry about can
you couple to unphysical modes? Well, there are more modes than Harjava gravity. There's more degrees of physical degrees of freedom. That's for sure. And there is where their norms are okay. There is a range of parameters where their norms are okay. So there are no ghosts, right?
Why?
Well, it's the life is such, you write the Lagrangian, you analyze it, there are no ghosts.
No, right? No, but if you violate the gauge invariance, you get coupling to unphysical modes of complex categories immediately.
If you violate, say, gauge invariance by introducing the mass for the photon, you don't do anything, you know, dramatic as introducing ghosts. This would be massive photons, everything will be fine, right? So that doesn't mean that if you deviate from some gauge invariance, you necessarily will get ghosts. That's not true. Okay. So let's now formulate the question. Can we take this Harjava-Lifshitz proposal, and the idea is that good UV behavior of gravity. Seriously, despite the fact that of 100% Lorentz violation in gravity sector. So my answer is, well, yes, if we seriously. My answer is yes, as long as we require the scale separation, that the Harjava-Lipschitz scale is much below the Planck scale. So basically, what how this story unfolded is that the idea is that you have a meta sector, and the gravity sector, and then in the meta sector, the idea is that you maintain normal propagators, normal scaling. Because I want to start from something that is already close to Lorentz invariance. And in the gravity sector, and that's the only sort of bad interaction in the Stern model, because it has 1 over M Planck times the energy, right? And insist on gravity being completely different, and go to Lipschitz scaling at lambda Harjava-Lipschitz much smaller than M Planck. All right, so that's kind of a framework that we have looked at, and in this framework, yeah, absolutely, that's what we did do. So now we ask the question: will this be maintained at least at the approximate level, and whether we have a sensitivity to UV scale or not, right? At that point, once you formulate this, and let's say we have analyzed the following model, this L matter is d mu phi star d mu phi minus 1/4 f mu nu squared. So this is a scalar QD. You have charged scalar and charged and the photon, right? And if they're we just didn't want to play with fermions. So then in that model, you can calculate the corrections to the propagation speed due to attaching gravity to this thing, right? And that's that turns out to be calculable, well, thanks to this change in the dispersion for the gravitons, and that's what precisely we did some years ago now. And I just want to say that if both matter and gravity sector become sort of part of Lipschitz sector, no matter at what scale, there is a problem, because then just simple like QED loops will induce too much of Lorentz violation, that the theory will be dead from the start if you really think of it as a theory of nature, right? Anyways, that's the starting point, plus Kharjava-Lifshitz gravity, which is it's too long a Lagrangian to write down, but the amazing thing that we did muster one loop calculation in this framework with some hiccups, but we did nevertheless. So basically, the idea is that you have this phi scalar, and then you have a graviton exchange, which now has spin 2, spin 1, spin 0 components because of all, well, it off-shell it has anyways, right? But it, one has to take that into account. And we do the same thing with the photon where you calculate again graviton exchanges. And you combine everything into the C of phi minus C gamma observable, because that will be the observable. And we have calculated all these loops by basically the standard, if not too naive, a technique by separating phi and then the gamma into low and in the fast and slow degrees of freedom, integrating out fast degrees of freedom and so on. So the conclusions that we have found. Yeah, this is all flat space, right? So there are people in the room who are more worried about non-flat space parts of Kharjava gravity and so on, and for that the super high energy behavior may not be that relevant, right? So I'm looking at really high energy behavior. Yes.
Why does the interaction between your scalar and your photon play any role?
At a higher loop, it may. Yes.
But so, did you analyze that? I mean, I'm just wondering why you took an interacting matter model.
No, we did not. Sorry. Yes. That's what we did. Right? Sorry. Yes. We could, yes, but that would be in a higher loop order, right?
I just really meant, is there any reason to think it would bring in any new feature?
No, no, we haven't. I have not worked it out, right, but I have looked at it and I haven't found any, additional badness sort of coming from the interaction.
So the one zero modes are not specific.
What's that? They have all propagators. There are physical modes right now. This
two is usually the physical.
Well, there is no Lorentz invariance, but there is some other invariance, right? In this 3D sense, we do implement all that. We fix the gauge. We do all the things that air particle theorists will do, right? And then we calculate these loops. So the propagators are all well defined, and
you have to assume additional invariances to get rid of the physical coupling.
No, there's no there is some sort of since there is no Lorentz invariance. You may ask a question: how is the gravitons coupled to matter, right? So in principle, you could have additional, violation of Lorentz invariance there. What we chose is like, 4D, normal inspired 4D Lorentz invariant coupling here, right? But because the loops are sensitive to this. Crossover scale, the result is non-zero, right? This is non-zero. And the answer is for spin 2 and spin 0, one can show explicitly that this delta C is proportional to, I probably have some answer, but doesn't matter. I'll just flash it that it's Kharjava-Lifshitz squared over M Planck squared. There is probably, the loop factor where we calculate it, and there is a log of lambda uv squared over lambda Kharjava-Lifshitz squared, and that is using what's called z equals 3, I think, scaling that one could have introduced even a higher dimensional term here in the propagator, in which case the logarithmic behavior will be changed to a super convergent behavior. So just looking at this answer, you can see that, you know, since this is supposed to be less than 10 to the minus 22, you can kind of see that this answer will be all right if the crossover scale is maybe 10 orders of magnitude or so smaller than the Planck scale. So the answer is that, yes, well, at least there is no immediate death to the model if we take crossover scale to the Harjava behavior, much smaller than the Planck scale, not at the same scale.
So is it the spin? So if you had done this with two scalar fields, for instance, you'd expect that there would be no delta c.
No, there will be no delta c.
So it's the spin of the
photon. Yeah, it's the spin of the photon. Correct. Yes. So they couple slightly differently, and so on. So now I would also argue that spin one have presented in this framework, have presented a certain problem. If we just proceed the same way, what we found is delta C is proportional to just quadratic scaling as before. So this is an issue because we have basically a short answer is the spin one gravitons and Harjava Lifshitz have unmodified propagators, 4D propagators, and that gives you the answer that you'd expect in the normal gravity, right? Because of the non-Lifshitz propagators for G0i, let me call it, or something like that, for the vector modes of gravity.
If you give the graviton a mass, you pick up.
There are many experts in the room who can give graviton a mass, but don't.
The mass, you pick up 1.0 x equals 3, but then you can do proper, and this gives you a new invariance. But then you could get a strong coupling with the scalar in this
model. Yeah, there has been a lot of discussion on what happens to scalar modes and so on. In original Harjava gravity, there was one term missing that can be added according to the symmetries and so on. And it turns out it should be added. But once you do that, there is no immediate death to the model all right. So just returning to this, it might be a problem for the construction. So now it depends on how you know, once you get something like quadratically sensitive to the scale, then it's usual sort of particle physicist musing. If you argue that, Harjava Lifshitz is the ultimate highest scale, and after that, nothing, right? That you might choose some other ways of calculation, some other regularizational schemes that will not lead to the UV scale, right? It's like with the Higgs mass. If you say, well, there is nothing, no thresholds beyond weak scale, and then you choose dimensional regularization, there is nothing. Or you so it's either lambda Harjava Lifshitz is the highest energy scale, highest physical energy scale, which is
for
I would say for anything, right? For matter sector as well, right? For the highest physical scale, or more likely, or modify Harjava proposal to K pure spin one propagators.
So I don't understand exactly. There's no on shell spin one particle in Khoshalovich's gravity, right?
Yeah, but off shell there is this contribution.
But so are you saying, suppose we didn't even couple any matter, we're just looking at the gravity part. Are you pointing out that there's a...
No, and it's somehow important that the matter propagator was non-Lifshitz. So if I would put a matter into Lifshitz behavior as well, this will go back to Harjava-Lifshitz scale. It really appears from this type of diagrams where this is spin one, non-Lifshitz propagator, and matter, which is non-Lifshitz, right? If I go back to the Harjava construction where I would assume things that everything is in Lifshitz behavior, right? Then there will be here there will be a Harjava-Lifshitz.
Right, then,
then I have a problem of huge magnitude that I don't know how to come back. So that sums it up. So I would probably go along the path of modifying spin one part, which meaning in Harjava language, including high dimensional, from his point of view, high dimensional operators into the game.
I thought he did include that. Oh,
in spin one. Yes, yeah, so it's a higher than z equals 3 in the spin one.
But is that all that's in you? So just make the Lifshitz scaling z.
Yes, yeah, so well, we have presented an operator that does, if I go back in time, that does kill that problem, yes.
So do we lose something important from the Harjava-Lifshitz idea if we take z4 instead of 3?
I don't think so, no. So in some sense the answer is probably positive that one can still keep the speeds of particles the differences under control and one has to do something about this spin one part.
But so wouldn't they say that the theory is not renormalizable because of this spin one thing? I mean, I don't know if that's what Ted was going to answer, but I mean, if you just forget about this power counting renormalizability argument, if there's a sector that appears in a loop,
it's a good question indeed. What happens the divergence itself does not necessarily mean that the theory is non-renormalizable, right? Like Higgs mass has a divergence, but it doesn't mean that it's non-renormalizable.
Right.
So for us, it's more like an issue of is there a huge fine-tuning at the level of 10 minus, well, I don't know, 20, right, or not, right, from the start. And, do I have to do subtractions where?
You can do that with the Higgs.
Yeah, that's...
Get into a normalization group. Get rid of
You could, that's what I said, right? You could find, if there are no higher thresholds, there might be that your Harjava-Lifshitz is the highest energy scale, and then you can kind of probably convince yourself that you can calculate things such way that this quadratic divergence never occurs. All right, so that is sort of a semi-hopeful answer that one could have this bad Lorentz invariance behavior under control. So returning to this picture of 3D lattice, right? I would argue that it corresponds to this sort of 1 over lambda Harjava-Lifshitz being much larger than the Planck scale, Planck length graining, right? So this is L Planck. That this is the matter somehow feels doesn't fill this big lattice because the coupling to this big lattice is controlled by 1/m Planck parameter. Right? So the consequence of this construction is basically is something I don't think I emphasized quite a lot, and is that the gravity freezes, right? Sort of naively, right? In a sense that Harjava's idea was that, all right, above Harjava-Lifshitz scale, everything starts maybe flowing, maybe logarithmically, right? There is a logarithmic running and so on. But the scale at which you switch the sort of effective gravitational constant scale is proportional to Harjava-Lifshitz scale over M Planck squared. Now we have coupled this directly to the observables that have to be really tiny. So the idea is that, you know, in all practical sense, if that proposal works, then the gravity just freezes over, right? I mean, at the scale of above Harjava-Lifshitz scale. So in that sense, like the questions, oh, is it becoming asymptotically free or not? It's becoming really some sort of a really academic question, right? Because if your coupling is 10 to the minus 20, well, where to see it running, you need to go to the scales 10 to the power 10 to the power 10, right? So which is okay, maybe not. So maybe not so interesting. So the gravity in that picture freezes over. So now there is, since I have 15 minutes left, I'll go over the next sort of ideas that we have looked at. And it's going back to the meta sector and asking what is the origin of Lorentz invariance in the meta sector. Well, one sort of tentative answer that we gave long time ago is what, and in the meta sector in 1/m Planck going to zero limit. Let's ask this question, right? So what is the origin of that? And one answer that we have provided some years ago was supersymmetry. So if you think of some sort of preferred frame for a fermion, right? That in particle physics language corresponds to dimension 4, and in principle there can be dimension 3 operators. And then the question is what symmetry can you cook up that will forbid that? And it turns out that supersymmetry is actually quite a good candidate for that, because if you go from this to the superfields, it turns out that to generate some Lorentz non-invariant operators, you would have to cook up something like high dimensional operators that at the level of the Kähler potential or the super potential. So,
how delicate is the matter content have to be adjusted for this mechanism to work?
It has to be adjusted, but not so delicately. In principle, if you have two superfields that are two chiral superfields, you can put them into the superpotential in dimension 4 operator. Okay. However, it turns out that if these are charged fields, this term does not survive. So the gauge invariance of this term model, gauge interactions, are actually forbidding certain interactions. If you would have just a Yukawa interaction with superfields and so on, you could write a dimension 4.
Is any gauge invariance good enough, or does it have to be a special gauge?
So far, we saw that any gauge invariance was good enough. Right? One can argue that, MSSM or Stern model does have some superfields that are right-handed neutrinos. However, those are heavy, so they don't pose a problem. So, anyways, once SUSY is broken, then dimension 5 or 6 operators, of course, mutate on various loops to dimension 3 and 4, but the mutation is controlled by a dimensionful parameter, which is soft SUSY breaking. And then you can argue that M soft squared much smaller than the scale of Lorentz violation is a sufficient condition to preserve a high degree of Lorentz symmetry in the metasec. Now, I...
Hold on 1 second. What would this Lorentz violating scale?
Well, it's if I go to dimension 6 operator here, right, it will come with some lambda Lorentz violation squared, right, operator, right? So if...
Just whatever's in this supersymmetric.
Right. If my supersymmetry is broken at the Planck scale and all the super partners are on the order of the Planck scale, it's no protection at all, right? That's all what I'm saying. Yeah.
Can I just ask an almost philosophical question? So it's possible.
Maybe I'll finish and then because I went to get to this stage where the last. Hold your questions, please. So the last part was so we have L meta in the SUSY sector. So the usual story is that, well, you embed it to some supergravity or something like that. But now the idea is that, well, gravity is an Lipschitz sector and it has all this higher dimensional operators, derivatives, and so on. What are we going to do? Because this is not that easily generalizable to supersymmetric models. So what we propose is that there is a meta sector which is supersymmetric. And then you couple it to L gravity, which is in Herjava-Lipschitz. So forget supergravity. That's the short answer. So couple to the gravity in the Herjava-Lipschitz sector. But the point is that the couplings here are necessarily proportional to 1 over M Planck. And here, make lambda Herjava-Lipschitz, again, much smaller than M Planck. That will make sure that whatever bad behavior comes from non-supersymmetric gravity does not spill big time into the metasec. There is no gravity in that construction.
But this is point of nature.
Yeah, the whole construction here is saying that gravity is super special, has nothing looking absolutely not like anything we know. And the only reason to support it is that its interactions are indeed very, very different from the rest of the matter.
So
okay. I don't know. I mean, I have...
this also applies to the wider nature, not wider in the Lissing rings and the vector sink, but it would do some of the gravity sink.
Well, well, this is
a philosophical.
This is okay. This is not a philosophical question. Very good. So, anyways, we kind of like the this idea for to investigate because there aren't that many papers that analyze explicit breaking of SUSY. Right. This is not a soft breaking of SUSY. So SUSY here is broken. You know. 100% and explicitly. And then the question is, so could it be like a source of SUSY breaking anyways, right? Because for those of you who know supersymmetric theories, this is sounds a lot like gravity mediation, right? Because the breaking is controlled by 1 over m Planck parameter. And in normal SUSY breaking, there will be a secluded sector that condenses some fields, auxiliary fields, and you get the soft breaking in the matter sector. But here, the question is to have explicit breaking in that controlled by this. So we did, since we are very much aware of this dichotomy, like lambda UV squared divergence, what to do with that, and so on, we chose the Lagrangian, now I'm writing a superpotential, that is having some having some light and heavy fields, and otherwise supersymmetric, and we couple it to the. I have to look up the superpotential that we have chosen, and we couple it to the gravity in the Harjava sense. So this is equivalent to lambda. Heavy, sort of lambda UV. And gravity, we were kind of not too enthused to do the whole whole story for the Harjava gravity. So we chose some sort of scalar gravity that couples to T mu mu from compose from the matter sector. And the idea is that this is the standard model-like field, and it's light. This is some scales at the UV scale field, which is heavy. And so what we did, we basically calculated.
Wait, I'm sorry, Max.
Yes.
Don't forget this is the strong gravity seminar.
Yes.
So.
It's very weak gravity throughout my talk, right? I mean, it's just like that's the if anything, that's the feature, right?
But what I wanted to say is I actually don't know what you're talking about.
So this is a superpotential which includes a light field, heavy field. We do it just to substitute this UV cutoff, right? To introduce it more physically. Instead of having a UV cutoff, we introduce a very heavy threshold, right? Which will then provide you with the physical meaning of the hierarchy, right? That you have a heavy field, and we investigate how the mass of the light field is sensitive to the heavy field parameters.
And what is the heavy field mass field analogous to?
Lambda UV.
So instead of putting that in Lipschitz scaling and gravity, you just put in a heavy mass field. I lost the connection to the Lipschitz.
This is Lipschitz gravity, right? This is a Lipschitz gravity scale, which is a field that is coupled to T mu mu, composed
right.
out of light field and the heavy field. This heavy field we introduce in order to have an explicit heavy threshold in the theory, then any calculation, any regularization that you choose will have this dependence on this capital M, which is analogous to lambda UV, right? But the, it gives a physical realization to the dependence on the UV scale.
And lambda UV represents what in what you've been saying previously?
That's right.
Lifshitz scale?
No.
So what
no.
Is
Lifshitz scale exists in the gravity sector for chi, and the Lifshitz scale. And the Lifshitz scale is this, right? It's more or less the same as it was before. Right?
Okay, so what I was at, the one I don't understand is the UV scale. Is that playing the role of the Planck mass? Is that
right. Let's take this at the Planck mass.
Okay.
Okay. So the point is that if we switch off gravity, if we take this parameter to, 1 over m Planck here to 0 and keep this finite, right? There will be no correction to the mass of the light field, no breaking of SUSY, because everything will be supersymmetric and protected from renormalization by various SUSY theorems. Now, once you introduce this interaction, the SUSY is broken because this does not include any gravitinos or anything. So it's 100% breaking, but it's controlled by dimensionful parameter 1 over m Planck. Now, the fact that it's broken would be very bad for the mass of the light field, if not the mitigating behavior of the Herzhava-Lifshitz sector. So to see what it all sort of amounts to, we calculate correction to the mass of the phi scalar, and for that. You have to go through two loops, having a heavy particle phi here and exchange by chi. So if you remove this exchange, this goes to zero. Okay. If you keep this exchange, you get the answer that is proportional to 1 over m Planck squared. Then it will be lambda Herzhava-Lifshitz squared times m squared. So there is indeed a controlled breaking of the of SUSY.
So this is delta m squared of phi.
Of phi, yes.
Okay, so that's an index at phi.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Yeah.
But why is this good enough? So if capital M is equal to
the
mass, the Planck mass.
Yes.
Then this is a Herzhava-Lifshitz scale mass that
yes.
you're inducing.
Yes.
But that's
which I can take weak scale anyways. This is nothing wrong with that.
So SUSY breaking masses are usually taking over there the weak scale.
Right.
So
I can take it Herzhava-Lifshitz at the TEV. There is nothing.
We're talking about the inducing a mass for light fields in your supersymmetric.
That's right.
Like the electron.
So think of it as a Higgs. No, electron is protected by the chiral symmetry, so it's not going to work that way.
See, okay, but I don't know that. You assume that I know something.
No, this phi is a Higgs, right? That's the idea, or any super partner, right?
So there's only a small subset of the SUSY fields that are in danger of getting too big a mass. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not too big a mass because there is like two parameters that we don't know, right? There's m squared and lambda Herzhava-Lifshitz scale squared. Right?
No, I mean a priori.
A priori, no. There is absolutely every the SUSY will be broken, right? So all the super partners will get masses. Okay. So now, if we have an electron, the electron itself, because it's a fermion, its mass is protected. But scalar electron mass is, of course, not protected and will be expected to get mass.
Okay.
Another way to say it, SUSY itself is supposed to solve the hierarchy problem. So when you break SUSY, you don't want to generate too big soft masses for a scalar like the Higgs. And normally, when you explicitly break SUSY,
you will have a hierarchy problem because you will generate very big masses for the scalar. Our point here is that even though we have an explicit breaking of SUSY, we don't reintroduce the hierarchy problem because of the Forgrava Lipschitz scale. So it goes against the usual law of explicit SUSY breaking is equivalent to, it's bad. It's equivalent to reintroducing a hierarchy problem.
And the factor that cures it all is, of course, the switch to this Hargrave propagators above the surface scale. So just maybe I'll just summarize. So that's the end of the talk. We have I have talked about two constructions. One construction basically taking a gravity with a crossover to Hargrave behavior at the scale much smaller than the Planck scale. That by itself seems to be pointing that one could localize Lorentz invariance in violation in that sector, and not having a huge spillover to the Stern model sector. And also, one could entertain a possibility that, for example, supersymmetry is getting broken from that framework. And as far as I'm concerned, one could take this Hargrave-Lipschitz scale not too far from the GV scale. From what I said here, it does not seem to be a problem. Okay, GV scale doesn't mean that it's going to be discovered at the colliders because it's still a very, very tiny coupling of gravitons to anything else. Okay. And in principle, one can take this all the way to the favorite Clift scale, so milli electron volt scale. There's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, so.
So what would it imply about gravity? Nothing?
That, you know, it becomes some sort of effective and flows into a different regime at a micron scale.
So we've only tested gravity to a micron.
Yeah. So you can have, it will be degravitating beyond that, right? Because the force, here the force becomes weaker, right? If you exchange by a graviton and it becomes Hargrave-Lipschitz.
It means you'd never see primordial gravitons in the CMB.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I don't know. So there is many other directions one could take this. If you introduce a new scalar, a new sector, and you couple it to matter, and you make this scalar a new sector Hargrave-Lipschitz and really push the Hargrave-Lipschitz scale even lower, you can get away from various astrophysical constraints on the scalars because the emission will be suppressed as well. So for any sort of real emission of the Hargrave type scalars, you will get something like square root of E, which will, according to the dispersion relation behaviors, K cube over Hargrave Lipschitz squared or something like that. So you can cure various many sort of interesting things, and you can play a lot more with Hargrave Lipschitz sectors if someone wants to do that, right? That's it. Thank you.
Now can I ask my question?
Yes.
So this would be really attractive if there was some reason why it was natural to think of supersymmetry without Lorentz invariance. I mean, first you could be surprised that it's even possible to think of supersymmetry without Lorentz invariance. But the way I think of it is that supersymmetry is the square root of translation symmetry. It's not related directly to boost symmetry, except in that the way that you take the square root is somehow related to the space-time metric. But so what I really want to get at, and this is why it's sort of a philosophical question, is there some sense in which supersymmetry without Lorentz symmetry, that is with a preferred frame, is a kind of natural thing, or is it connected to any other ideas that you would have supersymmetry coming out in a context where you really only had spatial rotation symmetry, but not boost symmetry.
And it carries, if they, the charges carry spinner indices, but if you take those to these spinner indices under spatial, you'd have to do something where it carries spatial indices, you know, spinner indices under spatial SS3, under spatial SV2.
Well, that's how it works. Mm-hmm. That's how he manages to have Susie without Lorentz.
I don't think that's what, I think you, what Maxim just described, you wired both Susie and Lorentz symmetry together. So your matter has both Susie and Lorentz symmetry, mm-hmm. and gravity breaks.
Right, but
them.
I'm
so,
just talking
so
about the fact that the Susie that the theory has before it's broken, you know, is Susie without Lorentz boost symmetry. It's rotationally invariant Susie. And it's, of course, consistent with translation invariance. So it's just a smaller group than the Poincaré group. And I just wonder, from a sort of group theory point of view or some other ideas in terms of the nature of supersymmetry, is it natural somehow to implement it in a context where you have a preferred time-like direction?
Yeah, I don't know what to say. Didn't think about it that way. So here the Susie, like Lorentz symmetry appears to be like accidental symmetry of the lowest dimensional operators, right? That's the best I can say, right? But what it means from a deeper theoretical perspective, I haven't thought about it. No.
I mean, I guess I just want to make a comment. I do have a philosophical reason. I have one reason why I think it's natural somehow to have this, because there's something unnatural about boost symmetry, I think, at the groundwork of physics, because it's a non-compact symmetry group. And so to assert that the physics has Lorentz boost symmetry is to make an assertion about, you know, like an infinite parameter range of the symmetry group, and it's somehow, it's easy and beautiful to write mathematically, but hard to think about physically. But here we're implementing, it comes out as an accidental symmetry. It's not really exact. It almost seems satisfying that you have a way to make Lorentz symmetry emerge as like a really good approximation, even though it's not fundamental. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can do that with spontaneous symmetry break. You break SO3, 1 times of O3 by Mexican hat. Take the back of it, gives you by an effective field. And we get all the right stuff coming out.
Yeah, but that theory would be fundamentally boost invariant and it's spontaneously broken. What I'm after is fundamentally not boost invariant.
That's a nasty thing.
Well, I think it appears not to be.
I'm suspicious about that. This is heartbreaking, so.
Heartbreaking?
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah?
There are two ways of breaking symmetry.
Sure. Yeah, it's heartbreaking. Yeah.
It's
heartbreaking. Yeah.
It's
heartbreaking. Yeah. That's what I had in my head all the time, that somehow if there is a breaking of Lorentz invariance, it has to be like at IR scales, maybe some field condenses and so on. But this looking into this Harjava story convinced me otherwise, that you could have no symmetry to begin with, and still at low energy emerges as a symmetry.
By the way, there's no experimental evidence of a violation of Lorentz invariance,
I'm aware of that. My problem was with this Lorentz invariance violation. What is it good for, right? With Harjava gravity, at least I got some answer that, you know, it's not like, why don't we do it that way? But here, at least, you know, you get some benefits of, better UV behavior, and, you know, you may find it attractive that the graviton loops will suddenly becomes, you know, logarithmically instead of a quadratically divergent. I do find it attractive, right? So that's why I keep an eye on this.
There are two ways of getting a finite one graph. One is to violate the Lorentz invariance, and the other is to violate causality. This is, I keep Lorentz invariance. having all of the photographs, which is self-consistent and finite to all of those, unitary to all of those, gazing there to all of those above. So it seems strange that we have to violate the symmetry to get that. Because if we keep all the symmetries, we have this nasty non-normalizable quantum gravity, which has been going on for the last 70 years or whatever. This is a very strange situation.